You are listening to The New Man, Beyond the Macho Jerk and the New Age Wimp. Your host is men's coach and group facilitator, Trip Lanier. He is joined in the studio by the show's producer, Casey Capshaw.
Are you the type of guy that believes you should focus on where you're lacking? What are your specific strengths? Are you orienting your life around them? And how are the Chinese kicking the ass of Generation Y? Today, we're talking with world-renowned speaker and best-selling author Marcus Buckingham. Listen as we discuss the power in revealing the truth about you. Welcome to The New Man. Today we've got Marcus Buckingham. He's a speaker and author of four best-selling books. And I also saw a picture of him with that Oprah lady, too, on his website. So, Marcus Buckingham, welcome to The New Man.
Thank you very much, Chip. Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about what you do to help guys.
Well, the focus of all of my research is to try and help people identify what their strengths are and then contribute them to the world. So, my aim, I suppose, right from the first book I wrote, which is a book called First Break All the Rules, which is written back in 1999, and it was a study of great managers. What are the world's best managers do differently?
Okay.
And although they do all sorts of things differently, one of the main things that they do that makes them different from other less effective managers is they have a really keen insight that people don't change that much in terms of their natural talents or strengths. And so if you want to make the most out of a person, and that could be the person you manage or that could be yourself, you got to figure out what your strengths are and capitalize on them, and then figure out what your weaknesses are and manage around them. Don't try and turn your weaknesses into strengths. Instead, find out where you have some natural advantage over everybody else, whether it might be how focused you are or how empathetic you are or how competitive you are, how conceptual you are. Find out where you have some natural edge and then take it seriously. Refine it or cultivate it, sharpen it with new skills or new experiences that you put yourself through. Take it really seriously. Take your uniqueness really seriously and figure out ways to make a bigger contribution out of it. That's my focus and really has been since that defining study of great managers.
Excellent. I love the piece in The Truth About You, your latest toolkit that came out, where you talk about how in our culture, you may get a couple of A's and a C and an F, but in our culture, we choose to focus on the F, and your work is saying something different.
Yeah, I mean, if you ask American parents, your child comes home with an A, a C, and an F, and you say, which grade deserves the most attention from you? The question didn't say if you pick one grade, you must ignore all the others. It just said, look, as a parent, you've only got one thing to invest in your child, namely your time. So where should you spend most time? What should you spend most time talking about? And 77% of American parents say the F. So we're raising a whole generation of children who are characterized by the people who love them the most, namely their parents, by who the child isn't rather than who the child is. And, of course, that continues in the working world where you go and sit down, you know, to your first performance appraisal and your manager spends 3 minutes on what you did well last year and then spends 57 minutes on your areas for development or your areas of opportunity, which is really just a nice way of saying stuff you're bad at.
Right.
So if you're not careful, your whole career becomes one long remedial math class. And we've got to change that. Not that you should ignore the F. You can't ignore the F. But you don't call an F an area of opportunity. You call it an area of least opportunity, where you're going to grow and develop and be least creative. And then you need to call your strengths your areas of opportunity. Counterintuitively, you become most successful, most creative, most effective, most resilient, when you put strength on strength, when you cultivate your strength. And then you manage around your weaknesses. You manage around your F. You deal with the F. You don't ignore it. You deal with it. But you don't call it an area of opportunity. Or at least I totally misuses the word opportunity.
Exactly. One of the things that I liked and that actually impacted me was that you define a strength as something that actually strengthens you, not just something that you're good at. Because there's plenty of things that you might be good at, like bookkeeping or some other draining area.
Yeah.
But it's really about pursuing the things that actually have a, I'm just imagining, I've got to actually check in with my body and find out what actually energizes me and follow that. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, we are raised to believe that a strength is what you're good at and a weakness is what you're bad at. And one of the repercussions of that is that from a very early age, you're taught that you are not the authority on your strengths. Because frankly, your parents or your teachers or your manager at work probably is a better judge of your performance than you are. Probably people outside of you are a better judge of your performance. But to have a strength be just something you're good at isn't a very good definition, because as you said, there's an awful lot of things that every one of us is good at because we're capable or because we're smart or because we're responsible. There's an awful lot of stuff we're able to do, but some of those things drain us or drag us down or just bore us. Well, what do you call something? And that's the question I ask in the Truth About You is, what do you call something where you're really quite good at it, and because you are, people keep asking you to do it, and they might even pigeonhole you into doing it, but if you never had to do it again, it'd be too soon. Well, my definition is that's a weakness. If something weakens you, before you do it, you don't want to do it. And while you're doing it, you have adult ADD, you can't concentrate. Or after you've done it, you feel empty and drained. I don't care how good your performance is. I wouldn't call that a strength. That's a weakness. And of course, the opposite's true of a strength. A strength is an activity that makes you feel strong. And what that means is, before you do it, you look forward to it. While you're doing it, time goes by quickly, and you get into a state that psychologists call flow. And after you've done with it, it's fulfilling. On some level, the activity almost feels like God put you on the earth to do that thing. It's a very specific feeling, and we all know what it feels like. Well, if that's true, then you, each individual person who's listening to this, each individual human being on the planet is the best judge of their own strengths if they just know what to look for. You know your feelings better than anyone else. It's just that you've been told not to trust them. Well, that's a shame, because it means that we then are alienated from our own understanding of what our true gifts are. And that's a tragedy, because it means that you then feel less responsible for putting those strengths to work, which, as I said, is my mission, really, is that you should really take responsibility for identifying your strengths and then offering them up to the world. I believe that's what you've been put here to do. And if your strengths are what strengthens you, then it really puts you in a great position to take an inventory of which activities do make you feel that way, and then work out how you can cultivate them and offer them up to other people.
I think you mentioned something in the book that maybe 12% of people actually live their lives that are oriented around their strengths.
Yeah, and how tragic is that? I mean, how tragic, sorry to interrupt, but that's just a, you know, every company says people are our greatest asset. Well, not if you look at the data, they're not. You've got 12% of Americans say, I play to my strengths at work most of the time. 12%. Now, you wouldn't expect the number to be 80%. I mean, there's never a perfect fit between you and your job. But even if you give people 25% of every single day to fill with all the junk in their job or their life that they don't like or that bores them, that still leaves you, you know, a good chunk of your day, 75% of your day, 6-7 hours of a day, that you could fill with activities that invigorate you. And only 12% of us have managed to do that. And yet the funny thing is, Chip, if you ask people a very straightforward question, do you think you have the freedom to modify your job to fit your strengths? If you ask that question, only 16% of Americans think that they don't. So there's most of us, sort of 80-odd percent of us, think we have the freedom to modify our job to fit our strengths better, but only 12% of us have managed to do that. Okay, that's a tragedy.
It is.
If nothing else, it's a waste.
Absolutely. And what's underlying there? What are we just, have we just been kind of battered and beaten? Are we, you know, our souls have been just trampled? Or is it just the cultural, is it come back to that we focus on the F? Or what has us staying? I just see it like it's not being empowered.
I think that's, yeah, but you know, in the end, who's the one who can give you the power? My point in The Truth About You is, you are the one that has to take responsibility for understanding who you are, because no one else will. No one else will ever really know you like you know you. In fact, that's why in The Truth About You, I try and walk you through some very simple activities to say, how do you use a regular week of life to identify what your strengths and weaknesses are? And how do you drill down to the specifics of them so that you don't end up with vague, bland activities like, my strength is working with people. Or my strength is being challenged. But how instead do you derive or drive right down to the specifics of you know, what are you doing with the people? Are you selling to them or serving them or saving them or organizing them or analyzing them? I mean, what are you doing with to afford the people? I think in the end, we have so few of us playing to our strengths because we've been told that our most important moral responsibility is to try to perfect ourselves. But in fact, that really isn't the message. The message isn't try to perfect yourself. You're born perfect. You have to then make greatest use of yourself. You have to contribute yourself. That doesn't mean you have to try and become a jack of all trades.
Mm.
It means you've got to honor the uniqueness that God gave you.
Yeah.
And that means taking it seriously. Unfortunately, we've got our morality, I think, backwards. We think that our greatest responsibility is to plug our gaps.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I mean, I'm not saying you should ignore your gaps, but that's not the way to make a huge contribution in life.
Yeah. And I get that there's a radical sense of taking, like, radical responsibility for yourself. And even when I got the toolkit and I opened it up and there's a DVD and then there's a book and then there's this, what is this? This memo pad, the Rememo pad. And I'm like, oh, wow, this isn't going to be something that I get to just kind of a theory that I get to kick around. This is something that I'm actually going to step into and take, in a sense, really take responsibility, wake up to what I'm doing and take responsibility for who I am and what I'm doing in this world.
Well, that's right. I mean, I looked at that 12% number. And I said, well, we could start trying to talk to the corporations about how to change the way they select people or how to change the way that they promote or change performance appraisal forms. And we could change all those systems. But my point in The Truth About You was, let's start with yourself. Let's start with you. Because in the end, the company's, and I meant this point in the book, I mean, the company's never going to know you like you know you. It's never really going to understand what specific activities strengthen you and which specific activities weaken you. No one's ever going to know that kind of detail like you do. So the question that really organizes the whole toolkit is, do you want to be one of the 12%? And if you do, then how do you seize control of your life and push the world toward you, push the world toward the best of you? Every week, that's why I have this idea in there of a strong week plan. Every week, what are two things you're doing to push the world toward activities that strengthen you? Because if you don't do that deliberately each week, if you don't push each week, the world's going to pull you and yank you this way and that. And some of the times, you know, they'll pull you with offers of a new job or a better job, or maybe your wife will pull you with needs and expectations that she has, or a colleague will say, please help me, and you'll feel responsible, and you'll find yourself pulled every which way. And of course, sometimes you should chip in and help wherever you can, no question. Sometimes you should do that.
Sure.
But if you're not really careful, you end up being pulled off your strengths path.
Mm. Yeah, there's an integrity, like a deeper integrity to oneself. And I think, you know, when I talk to people about this, I think there's a hesitation of, oh, well, then I'm being selfish, that I'm taking too much space for myself, or maybe even a deeper belief that they don't deserve it. But I actually feel better when I'm around people that are taking responsibility for themselves, and the people that I've employed in past businesses, when they come forward and they tell me what they're good at, their strengths, it's an ease off of my, you know, I don't have to worry about that. It's like, great, go do that. That's such a gift to be able to have people that know this information about themselves.
Well, and that's not that you're letting anyone off the hook, and you shouldn't let yourself off the hook, but really, what's your responsibility? Your responsibility is to make your greatest and longest lasting contribution in life, whether it's at work or at home or in the community or in your church or wherever. You've got to make your greatest and longest lasting contribution. You can't do that if you're filling your days with activities that drain you. You can't make yourself love them. I mean, everyone is unique. We've been blessed with uniqueness. So if you're going to make a great and long lasting contribution, you've got to deliberately fill your week with activities that invigorate you. Otherwise, you'll burn out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's okay, I suppose, to be a martyr for a short period of time. All right, I'll chip in, whatever. That's mm-hmm. fine. I mean, that's not bad. But don't imagine that's going to enable you to keep being as good as you should be. You won't be able to keep it up. There's a law, really, that says that there are certain activities that make you feel invigorated and others that don't, and you need to honor both of them if you're going to make your greatest contribution.
We'll return to the discussion in just a moment. The New Man Podcast is celebrating its first year, and we'd like to offer what we feel is the best of The New Man. The Best of The New Man, Volume 1, is a 6-CD set which features, Well, the best of our programs in a high-quality, easy-to-use format. In these interviews, we discuss how to have difficult conversations with your woman. What do women really want from a man? How to be firm with someone without being an asshole? How to stay out of the friend zone? What kills sexual attraction in a relationship? How to handle blue balls? How to safely deal with your anger? And we'll also dive into the deeper questions like, why are you holding back in your life? Perhaps you know a guy who'd like the new man but isn't hip to podcasts. Or maybe you just want the convenience of our best shows on CD for yourself. Support the new man and go to thenewmanpodcast.com to purchase the Best of the New Man Volume 1 CD set today. As an added bonus, we'll throw in a free 30-minute coaching session with me, Trip Lanier. Thanks for listening, and now we head back to the discussion. I'm curious what you saw coming up, you know, that had you, you know, as you were a younger man or even going through school, of like, what the hell is this? What were you seeing around you that inspired you to take this path, to make these powerful distinctions, and then, as you say, really live this mission in your life?
Well, funnily enough, the first one, and you know, sometimes retrospectively, it's hard to figure out exactly what you felt at a certain age. But the first one was the defining quality of my life growing up was that I had a stammer, so I couldn't speak, or a stutter, whatever you call it over here. Mm-hmm. But from the age of 3 till about 12, I could not get a word out at all.
Wow.
And I went to every speech pathologist and child psychologist, and I knew more about the pathology of stuttering than I ever thought I would care to know. But it wouldn't go away. Until one day, I went to chapel every day. The school that I went to chapel every day, and we were supposed to read aloud in chapel. And normally, it was the senior boys that were asked to do that. But in the final semester of the school year before I graduated to being a senior. Now, that means that in England, you're 13 in the prep school I was at.
Okay.
So I was 12 years old, and they picked 6 boys from the younger year, from the junior year, as it were, to read aloud in chapel before the summer vacation began. And one of the boys they picked was me, which I thought was a rather annoying thing to do since everybody knew I couldn't speak.
Wow.
And I practiced the night before, and it was a disaster, and I could barely get anything out. And then I walked up the next morning with all the 400 boys staring at me, just pretty sure I was going to make a big old fool of myself.
Wow.
Which I thought too, by the way. And I turned to speak, and I was standing behind the lectern in the pulpit, and the words came out perfectly, just flowed perfectly. And I was as surprised as anyone else was. But as I'm standing up there reading from a prepared piece, like I knew I was going to say, two things occurred to me really clearly. One was, if I knew exactly what I was going to say, I could speak.
Mm.
Like, if it was written down, I knew exactly what I was going to say, I could speak. And second, if there was a large audience watching me, my mouth and my throat opened up and I could talk. And I realized that the more people watching me, the more fluid I became.
Mm-hmm.
And so from that moment on, when I was talking to a friend in the schoolyard, I would do two things. One, I would rehearse almost exactly what I was going to say. And second, I would just pretend I was talking to 200 people rather than 2. And my stammer went away in about 3 weeks.
Wow.
And from that moment, I was sure that there was a specificity to my understanding of myself that would be useful for me, not just in winning in life, but in figuring out how to neutralize my weaknesses in life, too.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one big insight, that it was like, wow, that's a trick. I used a strength to overcome a weakness. That's cool.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because some people are frightened by talking in public. If there's 5,000 of you, I am way better than if there's 5. I am so nervous when there's 5.
Uh-huh.
5,000, I'm golden.
Uh-huh.
And I think the second thing was, I was at university and I was studying psychology. And when you study psychology at university in England, you study sickness and depression and schizophrenia and neurosis. And I realized I loved psychology, but I hated that. I hated studying what was wrong with people.
Mm.
And I found instead a company, the Gallup Organization, that was involved in studying what was right with people. Study happiness, joy, success, mm-hmm. excellence. Not because you don't think that studying depression is important, that is, but because excellence is not the opposite of failure. You can't infer happiness from studying depressed people, just like you can't infer what makes a great marriage from studying people who divorced.
Uh-huh.
So that idea that the only way to understand excellence or success in any profession, from housekeepers to stockbrokers to lawyers, was you had to study excellent practitioners. I know it sounds obvious when I say it like this, but at the time, that was radical. All of
that was the beginning of the positive psychology movement.
Yeah, it was Mike Chechen-Mahai, and then my mentor, Don Clifton, was the chairman of Gallup, and he was, I think he's generally considered to be the grandfather of positive psychology. Maybe Martin Seligman, Ed Diener, Mike Chechen-Mahai are what you might call the fathers of positive psychology. But Don really was the grandfather of it, the idea that the psychology was, as Martin Seligman said, half-baked, baked the bit about mental illness. But the part about what made life worth living, joy and meaning and fulfillment, psychology really hadn't studied that at all.
Yeah.
I mean, to give you an idea, there were 40,000 studies that the American Psychological Association, more than 40,000, that the APA had sponsored, and less than 400 on joy.
Wow.
Well, Don's point at the time was the balance is off. And so that, for me, as a young man, I was, 1983, 84, when I first came over to America, that was just so intriguing.
I'm struck by your story of having your stammer, your stutter, and it could be like, well, I just became a writer. I didn't go into speaking, but you actually embraced a strength that helped you move through that. I think something that's a powerful distinction, that it's not about making your life more and more narrow. It's about okay. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, I mean, you see, when you want people to experiment, you want people to try lots of new things. You want people, if you like, to explore the island. But if you're going to explore the island, like you would do if you were any kind of explorer, you've got to have a really firm beachhead. You've got to have a really firm foundation on which to begin your explanation or exploration of the world.
Okay.
And your strengths are your beachhead. My strength in terms of public speaking is I am at my best. I feel strongest when I'm talking to a large group of people on a subject I know a lot about, when I'm totally prepared, and when I know it'll further a mission.
Mm.
If you take any one of those different aspects out of it, any one of those different shadings of color out of it, then it isn't a strength at all. If I'm talking about a subject that I don't think will further a mission I believe in, it's not a strength. I'm left cold by it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to be an entertainer, for crying out loud.
Right.
Okay, well, that's all part of continuing to explore the island, right? You start with one insight at 12, and then during the course of your life, you continue to try new things as you add an aspect here, an aspect there, of what you really understand your strengths are. And that then leads you into all sorts of different career choices and opportunities. But they're not just, I'm not just blindly packing through the forest of my jungle with machete. I kind of know a bit about myself. I know what strengthens me, and that serves as a launching off point. It also serves as a map as I navigate around my island.
Mm. Tell me a bit about The Truth About You. How did it come about? It's not just a book. It's a toolkit, really. You'd written the other books. How did you arrive at this?
We found data early this year, and it was confirmed. I do polls of the working population of the U.S. every 6 months. And the data shows that Generation Y, people just starting their careers and in their 20s and early 30s, they are the most remedial of all the generations. So if you ask them, which do you think will help you win? Which do you think will help you be most successful in life? 69% of people under 25 say fixing my weaknesses.
Wow, okay.
You contrast that with China, which over the last 8 years has flipped completely, and now you're at 70% of people in China say strengths.
Hmm.
So I was looking at our largest economic competitor and seeing how naturally strengths-focused and entrepreneurial China was.
Mm-hmm.
And I was contrasting that with the brand new 71 million Generation Y cohort charging into the workplace with a completely remedial view of themselves. And I thought, this can't stand.
Yeah.
I've got to get something out there that if you're young and you're hungry and you're impatient and you perhaps don't have time to sit and read a 300-page book,
mm-hmm.
How can I grab you? How can I get you at least thinking about your unique strengths and weaknesses in a more coherent way?
Mm-hmm.
How can I get your attention, and how can I get you to take it seriously?
Mm-hmm.
So that's why in The Truth About You, we've got a 20-minute short film. The book is about 100 pages long. There's the Rememo activity, which actually gets you to dive into a regular week of life to identify what your strengths and weaknesses are. My goal was that managers around the world or around the country would say, look, to their, I don't know, their 10 direct reports, they'd say, look, go take this and come back to me in a week. Mm-hmm. And then we can talk to you about your career. Then we can talk to you about your performance. Uh-huh. Then we can talk to you about how to grow and get better. So I wanted it to be this export strategy for managers and teachers and coaches to get, frankly, to get, you know, people in their 20s and early 30s, get them on board.
Yeah. It's almost impossible not to do. I got it. I mean, I get a lot of books because we interview a lot of authors and stuff. And this, I just cracked this one open, and then an hour and a half later, I was done. Like, yeah. I never stopped. It just was so easy. And I looked at it and I was like, oh, I could do this. It never had this point of like, oh man, this is too much work and I'm not going to get through this. And I was inspired to go through it because of its simplicity. And what I got was just how effective it was going to impact my life in a very short period of time.
So my hope was that it would be eye-catching, and then that the actual material itself, as you said, it wouldn't be arduous, but at the same time, you would be challenged perhaps in ways that you hadn't been, to think about yourself, not in some airy-fairy, self-esteem building way, but in a pretty serious way to go, wait a minute, Trip, who are you? Come on, man. If you don't take yourself seriously and look in the mirror and deal with what you see, no one else will. People just will never know you like you know you, so might as well figure that out now.
Absolutely.
And then try and push your world toward it. So I'm really glad. If that's the way it works for you, good, because that was the intent.
Yeah, I just want to make it a prerequisite for any of my clients that I work with, because that's the conversation that starts the ball rolling. Where is it that you want to be? And we're going to base that off of your strengths and, as you say, neutralize the weaknesses. And the thing is it's a winning game. I'm fired up to do it. Wait a second. We're going to build a life around the things that I love to do and I look forward doing? Holy cow.
Yeah, and that's not that that's easy, but boy, it's an awful lot more fun to think about it that way than to try and push a noodle up a hill and say, okay, you're very good at sales and you're very good at presenting, but you're really not very detail-oriented. All right, now let's build a habit where you get more detail-oriented every week.
Ugh.
Come on. I mean, there's just an inherent resistance to that. It's like Tiger Woods has a strength, clearly. Back in 2000, he was number one in the tour in scoring average, number one in greens and regulation. And then he was actually number 63rd on the tour in a category called sand saves,
mm-hmm.
which normally we would say, well, that's an area for development, and you'll put that in your individual development plan. But he didn't do that. He and his coaches, they said, let's take your swing and rebuild it. Not to make it into someone else's swing. Let's make it your swing. Let's go with your natural flow, but let's make it shorter and more reliable and tighter and more predictable so that under pressure, it completely holds up. And what's interesting about Tiger is you look at him, today, he's number one. He was before he got injured and took the rest of the season off. Number one in scoring average, number one in greens and regulation, but he was 117th at sand saves. He'd gotten worse at sand saves. So, but of course, if you're never in a bunker, it doesn't matter.
Right.
If you're not that good.
Right.
Of course, Phil Mickelson is number one in sand saves, and he's in bunkers a lot. Same with Tiger. It doesn't mean you ignore his sand saves, but all of your effort and your coaching and your development is based around saying, you're good in this, you're good over here, you're drawn to this area. Now, how do we step it up?
Mm-hmm.
If this is the best you've got, how do you bring it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just a great lesson for kids. It's a great lesson for us as, you know, grown men.
It's very cool. Marcus, thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show today. I hope to have you back in the future, and we'll talk to you soon.
Lovely. Thanks very much, Trip.
Okay, Marcus.
Bye-bye.
Learn more about Marcus Buckingham and the truth about you by visiting thenewmanpodcast.com/Marcus. Remember to visit thenewmanpodcast.com and support The New Man by purchasing The Best of The New Man, Volume 1, 6 CD set. Thank you for listening.